Giancarlo Esposito. My God. So I want people to know a little bit about you. Obviously, you had this incredible career. You're one of the great actors today. You really are. You embody every character that you do. And as a fellow actor, I look at that and I admire that. I see what you're doing now with Adam Clayton Powell Jr. on Godfather of Harlem. And I look at you and I go, son of a bitch, he takes chances. You take chances. And that's what great acting is. You take chances and you make it work. And as a fellow actor, I just have to tell you, I admire that. I'm a fan of yours. And I mean that sincerely, because from all the characters that you do, you embody that character. And it's just, you know, I go, the guy just takes chances, man. And he wins, you know.
Thank you so much, Chaz. It's I've had a good run, and I'm so proud of Godfather of Harlem, especially because it's such a historically beautiful piece, but such a great statement about history. And when you have to play a historic character, you got to live up to someone who already laid it down. So
you embody him, and I just love it. Now people don't know, but you were born in Copenhagen, right?
That's right. I was born in Copenhagen in 1958. My father is from Naples, Italy. He and my mother met at San Carlo Opera in Italy. And then they traveled together as she was singing opera and then moved to a State Department tour of Porgy and Bess. So she wound up singing Supper Club Act with Josephine Baker in Copenhagen. My brother was already born a year before me in Rome. And I was born in Copenhagen. Then we went back to Rome, and I was living in Rome until I was 5 years old.
I mean, you were literally born into the business, really. I mean,
I was. You know, a funny story. My mother sang in the supper clubs in Copenhagen. In her time there, she had hoop dresses made, big, huge dresses that flowed out from above her stomach, so she could actually do these supper club acts until she was about 7.5, 8 months pregnant. So that's how she met Josephine Baker, and that's how I came to be in Denmark.
Oh, you know, and it's amazing, but I've been reading about you, and I didn't know this. You made your Broadway debut at 10 years old.
Yes, I did. I was actually, I believe, around 9.5. I did a show with Jack Cassidy and Shirley Jones called Maggie Flynn.
Maggie Flynn, yeah, wow.
And
1968. I said, oh my God, this guy has been around. I said, that 10 years old, that's just incredible.
Well, you know, as a youngster, you know, I was able to witness a lot of opera. My father was an opera lover. Of course, he's Italian, Neapolitan. And my mother then transitioned into being sort of my voice coach when I started doing one Broadway musical after another. And so it has been in my blood for many years. I thought I'd be a song and dance man most of my career, but I got bit by the acting thing. Because at that time in the 70s, you know, there was Pippin, there was Hair, African-American blacks got a chance to be on Broadway. My mother knew Pearl Bailey. And I thought that could be my life, but I wanted to do something more and something truthful and honest that allowed me to be use all of my facility, not just my song and dance man facility. And so I pursued dramatic acting for that reason.
Wow. You know, Giancarlo, and a lot of actors and people watch my podcast, and I get some actors and they always tell me, they say, you know, I'll get an African-American actor and say, well, you know, I'm not black enough, or I'll find one where they say, and I look at you and I go, he's an actor who has taken his mixed racial thing and has made an incredible career. Have you ever, what would your advice be to someone who was like mixed racial? Because I see that a lot now in my master class, where they come to me and they go, you know, I'm half African American and half white. And I say, okay, so just be a good, I go, yeah. Just be a really good actor. The part will find you. Don't worry. Just be good. I said, you can't control that. You are what you are. So just, you know, be good.
Chaz, that is great advice. For me, to get work was a survival issue. And so, you know, being Italian with a name like Giancarlo Giuseppe Alessandro Esposito, everyone says Esposito in America, but it's really Esposito. Right. I was challenged to learn how to do a Spanish accent and learn how to be a Black tough kid and do the Black idiom so that I could work. What I would say to someone who's mixed race is learn everything about both of your races, both of your cultures, and then be yourself. I had to transcend that because I found there was an angry element to young Black actors who couldn't get work. They got a little angry. I would go to auditions that never mentioned what color they wanted someone. Now, I've been in the room, Chaz, where I've gone into audition. I walked into a room and there's a bunch of white guys and they call my name, Giancarlo, and then they go, oh, we're so sorry. You know, we really wanted the Caucasian for this role. We didn't know that you weren't white. And that was the beginning of me having to create a self, really find my own self within not only the racial bias that went on in acting, but also within my desire to be me. And so I went, okay, I'm going to learn it all. I'm going to learn how to be Spanish. I'm going to learn how to be Black. And the Black box that they wanted to put me in was the killer, the crook, the robber, the beef. And so I did that for a while until I could graduate and do other things and convince people that I had the talent to be colorless and to have a complete control over who I am as a human being. And so I've been, I think, lucky to be able to cultivate that and see the difference within that.
Wow. I personally think it's an advantage. You know, you could play so many things. And I'm glad that you said that because you said it so eloquently that better, because so many people are from biracial families now and they're actors and they come to me and I just tell them to be good. But the way you said it is just do it all. Just like you said, do it all.
Why not? Why put yourself in a box? You know, when I was young, I always looked to some of the greats that were my mentors. One, of course, was Sidney Poitier. And the reason I loved him was because he embodied a self-respect and an intelligence and yet a spirit that was strong and didn't take a position of color, even when he played someone who was put in that position. So I had a great amount of respect for him. But I also had a great amount of respect for Burt Lancaster. He was, you know, and I worked with him on a piece called An American Christmas back in the late 70s before he passed away. And because he, to me, had the essence of being a real man, not only a tough guy, but also able to be sensitive and smart. Equally so, Robert Mitchum. Harry Belafonte showed me and taught me how to be musical within my work, because I believe acting is an experience that's complete. And you use the word embody, and I think I get taken over by roles. I want to know who these men were as I researched Adam Clayton Powell and created my world within his. That's a great task because he really lives. So listening to his speeches, looking at his writings, finding out who he really was. Now with a guy like Gustavo Fring, I had to create that whole world. And isn't that what we do as actors? We create our world. With the historical piece that's given to you, you'd think it'd be easier. But it's not really, because for me, I've got to live up to who he really was. And for Adam, he spoke a certain way. He had a very different cadence, the way he talked. And so that's even more of a responsibility. But for a character that you start from scratch with, you have to have ideas. And those ideas come from inside.
Right. He was a bigger than life character, this guy. I remember him. You know, I'm old enough to remember him. And I remember, you know, his on TV. I mean, he was like, but like you captured it, you know, he was bigger than life. I mean, wow. I mean, when I saw you do it, we haven't worked together on the show, but obviously I'm in a different world. I'm with Joe Bonanno and you're with Adam Clayton Powell, you know? So, but wow. I just love the show. I love Forrest. Forrest is so great in it. And, you know, Vincent is so great in it. D'Onofrio, and we have so many great people on. I mean, everybody, you know.
And you're great in it as well. And Sorvino, who I saw a bunch of your buddies and our friends who I hadn't seen in so long last weekend. I went down to the Mob Con, the Sopranos. I call it the Wise Guy Con, but it's really a celebration of the Sopranos down in Atlantic City. And they invited me at the last minute, so I saw Sorvino and all the most of the folks from the Sopranos and Do the Right Thing. And your face was shown a lot because I had a lot of clips of your films.
Oh, because the Bronx.
That's right.
If there's a mob movie con, I'm sure I'm there somewhere. You know. Now your first movie was in 1978, I think it was. No, 79, you did a movie called Running. I think it was a little movie, and that was like your first really, and you played a Puerto Rican.
I sure did. I was working with Michael Douglas. I played a Puerto Rican kid, which was probably the first time offering of me as a Puerto Rican. And I'll never forget that movie because Michael was really lovely to me. He was young and he was obsessed with the movie and with running. And I was a runner. I've been a runner all my life. And slowed down a little bit as you get a little older, but sure. I used to always do that Central Park loop. So to do that movie and play that character was really special for me.
So you were a runner. I'm kind of blown away by it because of something I'm doing and the person's a runner. Wow, that's really strange. I'm in a serendipity thing here.
I love it.
Yeah, no. Would you say, there's a lot of big breaks. I mean, people always go, what's your big break? I go, well, you know, my big break when I got on Broadway and I was an understudy on Broadway, maybe in 1982. It's like a series of breaks. But I know Spike, when you did Do the Right Thing, and then you did a bunch of movies with Spike. Would you say that was when people really started noticing you, the movies you did with Spike?
Yes, it was a wonderful time for me because I had done film. But I don't think the African-American audience really noticed me until I started working with Spike Lee. We did 5 films together, and it was a wonderful experience to be able to be a part of those films and to come to the attention of the African-American community, because that's a big audience. I think a big part of my success is that I've been able to cross over and play all different kinds of characters, Spanish, Black, some who are written as to be white. I'm doing a show now called The Boys. I play the CEO of a company called Vought, which is a pharmaceutical company that has ties to Germany. I play a guy named Stan Edgar. So I've created a niche for myself that's allowed me to be a human being. But that was a big break. Being able to do School Days with Spike, and I'll never forget going to the premiere and seeing myself on a huge screen and people really, the audience responding to me as they responded even more and Do the Right Thing to Bugging Out, that I had actually really transformed myself to a wider audience. The part of my success that's really happened and continued, it started for me then, was to do things in different genres or different age groups. And do all of them so that you are everywhere all the time, even if it's just a guest spot. You know what I mean? And that's what happened for me. I did Law and Order, you know, I would do all of these different shows at one time and I'd pop up and people would see me and go, oh my God, you're everywhere. Like they're doing today, because I've got a few shows today with Godfather, which of course we want more people to see, with Better Call Saul, the prequel to Breaking Bad, and also with The Boys and Dear White People. I'm doing all this at one time. I think part of, you know, I say, even though the pandemic is happening to all young actors, if you're not finding work now, this is the opportune moment in time to find work. Everyone's looking for product. We have all of these, the advent of streamers and cable changed my career because I wasn't tied up to do a show for 26 episodes. Right. You know, we're doing 13, we're doing 10, we're doing 9. I could bounce around and do 3 shows in a season because I was non-exclusive. And normally in the day, it's who's in first position, who's in second position. Exactly. But as you get wanted, people acquiesce. They give way. We'll take second position if you can be here on these dates. Yeah, I can make it.
Right.
And then you can do a variety of work where people are seeing who you are in a different way each time, which is wonderful.
I found the sexiest word in this business is no. I can't do it. when you say no, you can't do it. You know how to, what do you mean you can't do it? Why I can't do it? Well, we'll work it out. Just tell us what you got to do. I mean, people don't realize that, but people, young actors used to be afraid. Oh, I don't want to say this. They won't hire me again. I go, hey man, no is the sexiest word. Say it.
You know? It really is. It allows you to be honorable about your schedule. Right. And it allows you to be honoring yourself. We as actors, you know, when someone wants you and you have something else going, we're afraid to say no because we're afraid they won't come back to you. But right. That's a form also of your own self-respect. No, I'm actually booked on this. This is a bigger role, but I booked that first. And your integrity comes into play and people respect that. And they say, well, why don't you just let that go and do this? Well, because I went through the process. It's only a day. It's a small part. I'd much rather do this, but I'm going to stick with that. People respect that. And then they come back and go, you know what? We're going to work it out for you. It's just like if you were in first position and came, and I got your gig and it's a gig with Michael Mann, like I think of Michael because I did Ali with him. I'm going to honor that, even though it's 9 days over 4 months. Like I went, okay, Michael, listen to the deal. You know, I'm going to do the movie. But in between, I got to go gig other places. And you got to allow the studio to let me free. You can't time me. But we're going to pay you for all that time. That's all great. But I'm a working actor. And he was like, I got you. You know, and when he called, I made sure those days were free. Right. And the days, other days where I was needed somewhere else, I was somewhere else.
Right. I think as long as you're upfront and you're honest about it, I really think they're okay. I mean, I really do. I believe you have to be upfront and honest with people, you know.
That's right.
So we get to 2009 and Breaking Bad comes. And I remember that series. I mean, I remember because people were just, you know, everybody was talking about the series. I mean, everybody was like, you got to see it. I mean, I know people that just binge watched it. You know, they went crazy. But did you know? I know this is a crazy question because I get asked this ridiculous question, a stupid question, but I have to ask you because people ask me to ask you. Did you know it was such a great series when you got involved with it?
You know, they sent me, I wasn't familiar with it. They sent me a disc and I watched it and I thought there was magic happening, particularly in the writer's room and in conjunction with the care that they took to make the show. When I went out to do it, they asked me to do a guest spot. And I went out and the guy who opened the door for me in the van was a guy with a bald head and glasses. And I was like, oh, thank you. What's your name? And he goes, I'm Brian. And I went, oh, hi, Brian. And I went, oh, you're the guy. You know, he opened the door of the van. He was so happy to have me. I went out to do a guest spot. It went really well. You know, I had all these connections down to the clip-on tie that Gus was wearing because I wore that in military school, same clip-on tie. I was away for many years. I knew how to be kind and to people and ask them, would you like a refill? Is everything to your satisfaction? All those things that Gus did. And then I could flip on a dime and have this very cold stare, as Brian would say, you look right through me. Did I know? Yes. After I did the first guest spot, they asked me to come back immediately. Which before I got off the plane, they want you back. And I did another one, end of season two. And then they wanted to offer me a contract. And look, Chaz, your words play out. And I said, no. And they were stunned. My manager and agent were like, you know, this is the best show on television. I was like, yeah, I understand that. Well, why wouldn't you say yes? I said, because they're going on hiatus. Why am I going to go like that? The Velvet Handcuff now. Let's talk. They were shocked. I said, you guys go on hiatus. And when you're back in the writer's room, if you still feel the same way, then call me. And everyone was like, this guy is like, he's got balls. He trusts the universe, whatever it is. And I was honest about it. So they call me. And then I say, okay, I'd like to speak to Vince Gilligan. And they were like, oh, why? I said, because I want to know what his plan is. And it was out of a conversation with Vince that I said, look, I'd like to do this. I see that you're in need of a bad guy. You've had some bad guys come and go. I said, but I'm not the guy that's going to come and go. I'm going to create a character that's different. And he asked me, what do you think? Well, I don't want to create, we've seen the guy with the little, you know, poodle, you know what I mean? I said, I want to show you a guy who's part of the community, upstanding member of the community. I want to misdirect all of this, but have this guy really care about the folks who work for him. All of my ideas he loved, and I did the contract. And from then on, season three of Breaking Bad, I knew I was going to be around for a period of time. And I knew that eventually the town would be too big for both me and Cranston. But I knew I'd have the opportunity that this show was going to be a huge success. And so Vince says to me, it was after you came into the show. We had a show. The show was fantastic. But when you came in, you became a formidable obstacle for us, for Walter White. And right. you became someone who could train him and allow him and bring him in. But you could also be that formidable foe. And that, to me, he said it changed our show. And I said, well, it changed my life. So I looked at it in a very different way than I look at any other character.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Doctor, you have a question for Giancarlo? He wants to ask you a question. He's like saying, please, can I
Absolutely.
Ask you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I got a question. Thank you so much for taking the time, Giancarlo, really. My question is like, so when you were introduced in Breaking Bad, I mean, they just got out of business with Tuco and the most like loose cannon, crazy guy ever. And then they get into bed with you, like the most calculating, patient, like you said before, a cold staring guy ever. Was that a conscious decision to make him so, like the scene that comes to mind is the scene with the box cutter when you're in the downstairs in the laundry room. And I mean, what were your inspirations to make him like so calculating and then just cold, matter of fact.
I started to think about the guys who are in business on Wall Street and how they make decisions. And I think about the guy who's in a family business, who takes care of, pays everyone well, and has them feel like they're collaborators. Makes you feel good, he's graceful, yet he has another side. And in 401, we were just coming back from a break from the third season. And I wanted to be very specific about my work. It's the first time you ever see this particular character do his own dirty work in a brutal way.
Right.
Because he has a dual message to send. He had to send a message to Victor. Victor had made a mistake and it could not be corrected. He was seen. So he had to take care of Victor, but he also had to send a message to Walter and to Jesse. And it's after that episode, you knew that this guy is the baddest guy in this show. He's brutal. So for me, I knew that to be in power and control of and in a comportment, you know, Gus is very comported in that you can look into his brain and you can see that he's thinking things, but you don't know what it is. So he's very smart about covering his tracks, about creating a whole story that pulls you in that's not the truth, but he does it for a reason. So those were decisions that I made to have him be ruthless because I realized that when you're dealing with millions of dollars and you're dealing with drugs and you're covering your tracks and you're looked at like an upstanding member of the community, you have to be ruthless to keep that ruse going.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I like the scene when he doesn't kill his brother-in-law and he comes over to him and says,
desert.
I will kill everyone, your infant child. And I'm like, was that in the script? Was that in the script or did you throw that in?
I will kill your wife.
Yes.
Son, I will kill your infant child.
Wow.
Yes, that was in the script.
Wow, your infant child.
Yeah,
wow.
I mean, this guy means it too.
Yeah.
And I know that Brian, you know, a wonderful moment about that scene, you know, that whole scene is shot cinematically like a Sergio Leone movie.
Yes.
You know, Sergio Leone. And it, to me, that it was all shot in very wide shots until you get to the moment where I pulled that hood off of Walter White. And that's when I say those lines and he blinks his eyes open in the sun. Then you're in a little closer of a shot.
Right.
But this is a beautiful scene. If you look at that scene closely, you'll look at the clouds in the background, especially for Dante and filmmakers and young actors. And you'll see, as I'm saying those lines, Jazz, the sky goes from light, a huge cloud blocks the sun, and then it clears again as I'm saying those lines. Just magic.
I got to look at that. Wow.
You've made really like, I've, you know, watched tons of mob movies from my father and everybody. No character scares me like Gustavo Fring. None. Right. It is just,
it's great.
It is like, no, this guy does what needs to be done. And that's it. There is nothing else.
You know, that's right. You know, there's no discussion. There's no talk about it. Doesn't share it to get people's advice. He knows which way to go. Right. He's decisive. And this is a quality that, you know, I have four girls, four daughters who are growing up so quickly. My youngest is a filmmaker. We go to a Greek restaurant together that everyone's ordered. And it's like, everyone in the world knows the menu of a Greek restaurant, right? And they look at me and go, Papa, I don't know. I want to make up my own. They say, how can you be like that, but so decisive in what you do and precise in what you do as an actor? Yet we're sitting here at a restaurant. You don't know what you want. You know what I mean? They made me laugh quite a bit, but it came from me making decisions. This guy, I wanted to be like that, but yet being open and vulnerable to discuss it with Vince or have it change, but knowing that, you know, hiding in plain sight works. And yes. So that's the line. That's why I had to talk to Vince before taking the series regular job, because I wanted to be the guy who was affable and kind and lovely, fun, but he was hiding in plain sight. And that's the escape route for Gustavo Fring. Also harboring all the hatred for the Salamancas because they killed someone who was dear to him years before. And so revenge is another part of it. When you're vengeful, you're holding something and it has to come out somehow.
Wow.
So true.
that's great. I guess I'm not spoiling it because it's obviously been a while. But when you die at the end, when the actor, I forgot the actor, my God.
I just saw him yesterday, Mark Margolis.
Mark Margolis, who I worked with. I directed him in Oz. I love him. He was so great in that. And when you're telling him, you know, you want him to look at you, and he looks at you. And I love that he's flicking the button.
The bell,
yeah. Right. And you're looking at him, and then you realize, even in the end, in death, you know, your character is so smart, you realize, wow, you know, wait a minute. Uh-oh, I got to get out of here, but it's too late.
Too late. You know, that was a wonderful moment. Mark has such an interesting presence, and he's so wonderful when he can talk. In this particular role later he of course could not. He had to speak with that bell, but it was a great, great moment because Vince and I had a whole discussion about that, about how Gustavo might go out. And I said, well, you know, look, we've had previous episodes where Gus has walked into a hail of bullets and said, right, he's a made man, you can't kill me. And so, you know, when it was mentioned to me, brought me in his office and said, what if there were an explosion? I said, it just can't veer off into science fiction. If you do it right and it's real and Gus reappears after that, because he's stepping backwards, there's enough room for him to get away, you could have this moment that you really want. But he said, what would he be doing? And I said, well, look at when I'm Gus, I have certain behaviors that come naturally because I'm very fastidious. And so, you know, it's either, you know, being buttoned all the way up. And he said, well, what would Gus be doing? I said, you know, I'm constantly straightening my tie so I know it's where it's supposed to be. You know, I open my jacket when I sit down. When I stand up, I close it. I said, but I think he might be just getting the knot in his tie right to go to God. Wow. Or the devil. Wherever he's going.
Well, when you came walking out, and I was like, what? I remember that. I go, oh, come on. And then we obviously, when the camera sees the other side of your face, that was pretty crazy, man. That was
four and a half hour makeup, Chaz. I sat in the chair done by a guy named Howard Berger.
That was makeup.
No way. I didn't know that.
That wasn't CGI.
And so now we get to it. It was makeup. It was a prosthetic. So I have a bust of myself. In fact, I'm going to show you, because it happens to be here. It used to be in my daughter Ruby's room
really?
A long, long time. And And then she walked in and she went, she was so freaking scared. So I boxed it up and put it away.
Oh my God.
No way. So, you have that?
So this is the cast of my head and shoulders. And they use this to make the prosthetic that they put over here. And right, so that was all prosthetic and they applied it. And then afterward, they did do CGI where they then made the mouth. If you remember at the end, the mouth moved, right? The inside of my jaw. That's the only piece of this that was CGI. Everything else was 4.5 hours of application. How about that?
Isn't that crazy? It's so long for just a little scene.
Yeah, I've sat in makeup. Not 4.5 hours, but I did three and a half. And oh my God, I'm not a fan of that at all.
It takes a while, but this was an incredible moment. You ever see a film called Monkey Bone? I did a movie called Monkey Bone with Brendan Fraser. And Monkey Bone, I played a satyr, half man, half goat. And I was another 4.5 hour makeup. I had horns coming out of my head. I had grease paint that was red. I walked on my knees. And in walking on my knees, I could then carry a body on my chest, which was a smaller body with little legs that I could make walk if I walked on my knees. So I learned how to do this physicality to have the satyr walk. So it's my head and a little body. It's so effective. Monkey Bone's the movie. Brendan Fraser is starring in it. And
I'm gonna check it out.
Yeah, you gotta check it out. It's a fun film.
Hey, Giancarlo, was there a scene in Breaking Bad that was your favorite to do?
I love Box Cutter, and there's a reason I love it.
Nice.
Because if you're an actor, and if you come from theater as I do, 13 Broadway musicals, 10 plays, there is something about pauses. And they used to have, in the theater, we used to talk about Harold Pinter and the Pinter pauses. Also in Godot, Waiting for Godot, there are long pauses where you wonder what the actor's doing. It leaves space for the audience. And that's part of how I created Gus. Like, I would look and listen before I spoke. I'd check someone out, which makes people uncomfortable. That was something I used. So for me, Box Cutter is excellent because there are no words. Right. You know, you see Gus and he comes down into the super lab. He says nothing. He starts looking for something. Well, he goes and changes his clothes. And he's in, you know, he gets into, you know, the fishing gear, you know, which is designed.
It's so slow and meticulous.
He's slow and meticulous. He starts looking for something. You don't know what he's looking for. Right in front of these guys who are sitting there tied up while Mike stands there and Victor, who's smiling and proud, I can cook, screw these guys. There's no words ever said until the end. He does the deed. He goes back and washes off. He changes his clothes back. He walks back up the stairs and then turns around and says, get back to work. Get back to work. Those are the only words, 10 minutes. So to me, that's my favorite because we as actors, we cultivate voice. You know, I modulate my voice because I want you to hear it. For Gus, I take away my voice. I make you have to come to me. Like, if you can't quite hear me, it's okay. You know, I want you to come to me as opposed to me to come to you. And so all of those, and Box Cutter for me was a quintessential episode because I could shut up and just do it and have you everything through my physicality and everything through my emotion and through my eyes.
Well, the great Lee Strasberg used to say, the best actors do it with silence, with no words, no nothing. And I remember that. I never forgot that. You know,
I think it's a great point. I think it's, you know, to empower young actors to understand that we are interested in them. That what we do as actors, immediately you have to go, you know, if you are in the moment and completely embodied, people are going to be interested. They're going to know, what is this guy thinking? What is he doing? Right. You know, and that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I know we're talking about your character in Breaking Bad so much, but so many people have asked me about it. Please ask him this, please ask him that. And I said, I will. Giancarlo, what advice would you give to young actors today? And I always like to, when we get close to, when we're getting close towards the end now, what would advice would you give to young actors today when they say to you, could you give me some advice about getting into, I'm an actor, could you give me some advice?
You know, today I would say read everything. Learn about history, about art, about people, about music. But the one of the major things I would say is I love saying just do it, no matter what it takes. But I would say to young actors, start to write. If you start to write as a young actor, you're starting to create a world for yourself that tells your story or embodies a story that you want to tell. And then you can put yourself into that story. It becomes more personal. I am working on a Shakespeare play, which I always like Shakespeare because it allows you to use your facility, your lips. Yes. My mother used to say tongue and teeth. And so that's always important because it's important to be able to play characters who are not of your same culture. But I would say write for yourself, write for others. Understand the four-act structure, understand theater, do plays. For me, that was invaluable. Today we have young actors who jump right into television or get a film role, but the theater trains you the most because it allows you, if I'm sitting here throwing the ball back to you, Chaz, on stage, it allows you to cultivate. Everyone thinks acting is speaking and doing, but it's also listening, like hearing the nuance of your acting partner. So those are the things I would say to young actors. And then don't give up. Don't give up.
Of course. But I always feel that actors who could do stage can do film. Actors who could do film sometimes not necessarily could do stage. And it's not taking anything away from film actors. It's just that I'm like you. I came from the stage. And, to me, that's like the aerobics of acting. That's where I learned my craft. I mean, I still do my one-man show, A Bronx Tale, 34 years later. I still do it, and I love doing it because I know when I'm on there, I'm just working out for an hour and a half. I'm doing 18 characters. So for me, stage is so, so important. I think it's so important because that's where you get the nuts, like you said, the nuts and bolts of an actor.
I agree with you. It because when you think about it, I went to shoot yesterday. I had a bunch of stuff that was all in Spanish, which is great. Trains my ear, my lips, tongue, and teeth. But it's a page and they call cut. On the stage, they don't call cut. On the stage, you're either on the train or you're off the train.
Right.
So if you forget it, you got to make it up. If you get nervous, you got to calm yourself while you're
Acting.
You got to shut up and listen to your partner. You got to act and react, and you can't stop for 2 hours. It's gymnastics, like you say, Chaz, and it's the best training you could ever get. Ever.
Absolutely. What would you say? I want to ask you a couple of questions. Would you say your mother was the biggest influence or your father was the biggest influence or both?
I would say both. My mother influenced me in a creative way as a singer and trained my voice. That's the world she knew. My father educated me in a way that was globally cultural because he taught me, and now more than ever, I realize I've become him. I'm so Italian. Like, that's who I am. I gesticulate, and people are surprised. They go, oh man, they expect this guy who's quiet and soft like Gus when they see that performance. Right. But I'm really a guy who loves life. And my father taught me how to love life. How to appreciate art, appreciate music, as did my mother. My mother was more focused on me, on training me in a different way. And that's why I take her musicality and I put it into my physicality, because I believe that acting is also physical. To feel your body is important. And that's helped me with roles like Gustavo, who's very comported, a certain way of standing, straight back, and other roles like Powell, who's like out there. And is 6'2", and to be taller and command more space is a different attitude. All of those things are a part of the way I work as an actor, and they serve me well.
Right. Another quick question. In my show, we never talk about politics, and I like it like that. But I would like to ask you something. Growing up, was it hard for you to deal with being biracial, or you just, because obviously you grew up in a time where it was a little hard. to be biracial, isn't it?
It was difficult. I wound up in Elmsford, New York, out in Westchester County, going to an all Italian and black high school where I wasn't really welcomed. I was welcomed, but no one understood me. And right. So I remember Ronnie Carbone, who got me in a corner and started hassling me, big guy, football player. And I looked at him, I said, dude, I was born in Italy. Don't fuck with me. You know, and he was like, I said, I'm Italian. That's who I really am. You may see the dark skin, but I'm your brother. I'm your brother, you know? And I would tell him that. And then the blacks who didn't speak my language either, they were, you know, they were separate, didn't really want to accept me. So my best friend became a Jewish kid named Paul Bush. And he didn't care who I was. We were just friends. And so I came up in a way thinking I was an outcast. It wasn't until I was able to throw that off and claim my place as a human being, even through my years of working with Spike. I'm a human being. I'm not going to lead with my color. But it was difficult because I had to convince people that I was good enough at a time where the color of your skin determined who and how you were. I'm so glad.
I'm so sorry. We kind of lagged out for a second there. Right after you said I'm Italian, but I have dark skin.
Yeah, I'm Italian, but I as I said to Ronnie Carbone, I just happen to have brown skin, you know, and if you go, you know, and I was born over there, you weren't, but if you go over there, you're going to see, like I told my daughter, Shane Lira, who's now 24, when she first went to Italy, I said, because she was all doing her posing as a black girl. I said, you're interracial, but she was being a sister and it was all an act.
Right.
And she finally went to Italy and she called me 2 days later and she said, oh my God, Papa. I said, what? Because I told her, you're going to see yourself. You're going to see olive-skinned sisters who are Italian. You're going to see olive-skinned women. She has freckles with a little wave in their hair, straight hair like yours. You're going to see your Italian roots. And she did it, fell in love with Italy. And then she found herself. She had to play act and try to fit someone else's mode of who she is. Acting did it for me, to answer your question, Chaz. Acting pulled me out of thinking in a racial way and had me think in a more human way.
Well, you made an incredible life for yourself. You have a beautiful family. Your daughters are absolutely just talented and gorgeous. Oh my God. I don't know how I got one daughter and I'm like freaking out. You have God four. So I just want to say, Giancarlo, you've been an absolute pleasure. Do you want to tell the audience, what are you working on now? What they should look out for you right now?
Absolutely. I have a film called Beauty. That's ostensibly about the life of Whitney Houston, and I play her father. I have a big score with Mandalorian, Star Wars. Season 3 is coming up soon. Also, The Boys, Amazon Plus. That season 3 is slated to come up soon. And then Better Call Saul. I'm doing that as well. And developing things. And for all you young actors out there who are watching, even older actors, what you do today creates your tomorrow. It's the truth of it. If you spend 10 minutes a day doing what's going to facilitate your tomorrow, an idea, a thought, a podcast, a play, do that. Because that putting you in that creative space, it just attracts more creativity, more work, more opportunity. And so those are a couple of the things I'm doing. I got a great development with a couple of different networks about some historical characters that I think people should know about. And that's coming up soon.
Would you ever go back on the Broadway stage, you think?
Are you kidding me? The right play comes, the right musical comes. I'm there because I love the theater and it's embedded in me.
Right.
And you have to return to allow it to keep working for you.
Well, I want all the people who are listening to this. Did you hear that? Did you hear this? One of the great actors today, Giancarlo Esposito, what he said, do today what you can do tomorrow. He is saying, do it now. That's how you get opportunities. That's why, Giancarlo, you've been around for 40 years, and you're still at the top of your game. I want to thank you so much for being my guest on the show. God bless you. God bless the family. And you're absolute a treasure. Keep on going, brother.
Thank you, Chaz. So great to be here with you. Thank you, Dante.
Thanks so much. Great hanging.
Thank you. Honor and a pleasure. And I'll see you next time.
All right.